Good evening. I'm very excited to see all of you here and want to thank you for coming. This is a great opportunity to listen to the voices of people who have been thinking hard about what the Christian peace position might say to contemporary issues. And let me say a little bit about the contest that we're participating in tonight. This is the C. Henry Smith Peace Oratorical Contest. It is sponsored by Mennonite Central Committee U.S. through funding from a foundation that is named after C. Henry Smith. Smith was a faculty member at Bluffton College and at Goshen College. He wrote quite a few books and articles, and one of his primary interests was in the way that the Christian peace position was lived out in particular ways for him in the Mennonite context, but we expand that to involve all Christians who wish to speak to that tradition. This contest is administered annually by Peace and Justice Ministries of Mennonite Central Committee U.S., and students from all Mennonite and Brethren in Christ colleges in the U.S. and Canada are eligible to participate. So quite a few schools have these contests every year, and then the first prize winner from each contest is submitted via a tape and the written copy of their speech to the contest for the binational, among the binational group of Mennonite and Brethren in Christ colleges. Here at EMU, our contest is sponsored by the Language and Literature Department, the Department of Applied Social Sciences, in particular Peacebuilding and Development, and the Bible and Religion Department. And we have been very excited and pleased to find every year a group of really engaged students who want to participate in this contest. I will introduce each of them with their name and their speech title. So we're going to begin without any further comments, and I would like to introduce Jess Sario. Her title is Peace Churches and War Prophets, A Moment for Courage.
This is our Kairos. This is our moment as peace churches to lead the way and practice what we preach. Kairos is an ancient Greek word signifying opportune or supreme moment. It is also the word which resounded with Black South African theologians in 1985 when they published the Kairos document, the historic document which challenged the church's response to apartheid. 24 years later, the patriarchs and heads of the churches in the Holy Land have followed in their footsteps with Kairos Palestine, a declaration about the realities of oppression for the Palestinian people and a call for supporting a just peace. Specifically, they are calling for universities and churches to use the same tactics used in ending apartheid in South Africa once again, namely boycott, divestment, and sanctions. This is our Kairos. It is our opportune moment to respond decisively to the call from our brothers and sisters in the Palestinian church, from Israeli peace activists, Archbishop Desmond Tutu, and the prophetic voices within our own churches urging us to take our investments out of companies that support and profit from the Israeli occupation. The occupation, which puts 30-foot cement wall between farmers and their land, individuals and their employments, families and their communities. The occupation, which in clear violation of the Fourth Geneva Convention, has built and continues to build settlement after settlement on Palestinian land. The occupation, which allows the demolition of 18,000 Palestinian homes and counting, and the death of 355 children in the recent war in Gaza. And the occupation, which we are all complicit in. But we don't have to be. Mennonite Mutual Aid, the agency through which most Mennonite institutions and many individuals, probably some of you here today, invest their money, is a leader in socially responsible investment. Their standards of not investing in companies that violate human rights or promote warfare mean that most weapons contractors and similar companies are already screened out of their investments. It was surprising, then, to discover that the Mennonite Church, Mennonite Educational Agency, MEA, and Mennonite Mutual Aid, MMA, have not already divested from all companies that enable the occupation, such as Motorola and others. Motorola, up until last April, made bomb fuses for the Israeli army. After Israel dropped thousands of bombs in the 22-day war, they had to restock. Hence, bomb manufacturers and fuse makers such as Motorola made money. So everyone invested in Motorola, including EMU and MMA, made war profits from the suffering of others. It is a testament to the effectiveness of divestment that Motorola finally stopped producing those fuses after a concentrated and continual international divestment campaign. But Motorola continues to produce much of the intelligence technologies and communications equipment, such as surveillance towers in settlements, used by the military to facilitate the occupation. And we continue to support that. I first heard of EMU and Mennonites in general while living in Jerusalem when I met students from the cross-cultural program. At that time, many of my classmates and family friends were Palestinians that felt the effect of institutionalized racism and oppression in a very real and daily way. My friend Sahir, for instance, couldn't visit her parents in Nablus, though she lived in Bethlehem, a mere 35 miles away, because she could not get past the checkpoints. Later, I met Marwan, who spent over 2 years in Israeli jails without being accused of anything, and whose brother-in-law died because he wasn't allowed through the checkpoints to a hospital. I met a family who rebuilt their home for the third time after the Israeli army demolished it, claiming it was too close to the illegal settlement and the illegal wall. Over the past 3 years, I have immersed myself in Mennonite school, church, and culture, and have come to identify deeply with its tradition of pacifism, social activism, and prophetic witness. It pains me to think that EMU, MEA, and everyone else invested through MMA are still investing in companies that support the normalization of settlements, the operation of checkpoints, or the construction of dividing walls. It pains me to be complicit in the suffering of many of my friends in Israel-Palestine. And it hurts not just for the sake of my friends, but also for the Mennonite community, which is not living up to its own principles in this area. The words are all there. MMA's stewardship policy clearly states the companies they invest in should, quote, respect and support the basic human rights of all people to self-determination, and not, quote, take advantage of relationships with oppressive political regimes. Their stated policy and award-winning experience in socially responsible investment make MMA one of the best qualified institutions to divest from the occupation. As a student who, along with many others, has been pushing for this incomplete application of MMA's policy to be rectified for over a year, I have to ask myself, why hasn't this move been made? What are the obstacles, and how can they be overcome? The first obstacle is not equating criticism of the Israeli state with anti-Semitism. It is not anti-Semitic to hold the state of Israel accountable to the same standards of international law and human rights that we hold everybody else accountable to, including Palestinians. We do not and would not invest in suicide bombers. Why should we invest in home demolitions or the siege in Gaza? Too often, in our desire to identify with both sides of the conflict, we take a, quote, neutral stance, which is anything but. As Archbishop Desmond Tutu so aptly put it, if you are neutral in situations of injustice, you have chosen the side of the oppressor. If an elephant has its foot on the tail of a mouse, and you say that you are neutral, the mouse will not appreciate your neutrality. A delegation of representatives from MCC, MMA, and other Mennonite organizations that visited Israel-Palestine in 2007 was aware of this. In their open letter to the Mennonite Church, they clearly stated that, quote, the continuing Israeli military occupation and the dispossession of Palestinians is sinful. The letter continued by recommending that the church institutions, quote, avoid investment which violate the international law and promote violence. However, in a tradition which values relationships so strongly, there is also a fear that divestment would mean straining friendships with our Jewish brothers and sisters. But I ask you, what kind of a friendship are we to have with one another? Do true friends not hold each other accountable in truth and love? As 1 Corinthians 13 says, love does not delight, or I would add, refuse to talk about, evil, but delights in the truth. If our Jewish friends question our commitment to them or to peace based on our divestment policy, we need to answer confidently that we do not want to contribute to any of the cycle of violence, be it Israeli structural and military violence or Palestinian violence. Our love for God's people, all of God's people, requires that we first do no harm and then contribute positively towards peace. Divestment falls under the do no harm category. As another obstacle, you might ask, won't divestment mean losing money? There are several answers to this. Firstly, I would remind you of MMA's stellar work of accruing profits without compromising moral integrity. Socially responsible investment is what they do. Their faithfulness in this means we are closer to divestment than most. Secondly, history shows that in the long run, it can be economically disadvantageous to invest in injustice. But mostly, while understandable, I think that this is the wrong question. A better one might be, who are we saying that we are if we don't divest? If our identity as peace churches is to be bound in the tradition of prophets, the cry out, shout out, do not hold back, announce to my people their rebellion, is not this the kind of fasting I have chosen to loose the chains of injustice, to set the oppressed free? Let justice roll on like a river. Let us not grow weary of doing what is right, and even love your neighbor as yourself. If we want to claim that, we had better make very sure that we have our priorities straight. Peace churches should not be making war profits, period. Finally, there's the question of timing. I started off saying, this is our Kairos, and I believe that. Not just because divestment as a movement is growing worldwide, but because I believe that the right time to do no harm is always now. The right time to do what is right is always right now. We do not need to wait until every single voice has been heard. We do not need to wait until other mainline churches have taken this step. We do not need to wait to stop investing in human rights violations or in the suffering of our brothers and sisters. Dialogue and education about Israel-Palestine and debate about steps forward can and should continue. Divestment does not inhibit that. Divestment gives us clean hands from which to start the conversation. Like most steps towards justice, this step is actually very small. It requires that each one of us, which is invested in MMA, individually or institutionally, speak out and hold it and hold each other accountable to the principles of peace, which we hold to under the rule of the Prince of Peace. It requires that those in positions of power, our boards of trustees, pastors, and decision makers at MMA, listen and have the courage to be consistent with their own doctrine and policies. It requires, as always, prayer and humility, honesty and integrity in explaining our decisions to others, and ultimately going beyond words and into action. We can divest from the oppression of our neighbor. This is our Kairos. Thank you.
We're ready for our second speaker, who will be Sarah Roth, and her title is Respect the Powers to Affect the Powers.
The phones were ringing off the hook. I was running around the office like a crazy person, trying to keep everything under control. The phone rang again, and it was the call we were waiting for. The verdict has been decided, I yelled throughout the office, and everyone scurried out the door and upstairs to the courtroom. The managing attorney in the office and the head attorney prosecuting the case paused in the doorway. Would you like to see this? He asked. I was so touched, so I hurried to finish what I was doing. Don't rush, Sarah, he said. They can't start without me, and he winked. So I gathered my things, and together we headed to the courtroom. I walked in feeling proud that I was accompanying the head prosecutor and that everyone was waiting until we arrived. The judge entered, and he asked for the jury's decision on count one, guilty. Count two, guilty. They continued. It was decided that the defendant was guilty on all 5 counts. Back in the office, everyone was celebrating the victory and exchanging high fives. And while this was fun, I could not get the image out of my mind of the young man who just found out he was going to prison for 10 years. Something sank inside of me. How will I work here for a whole year? I have stayed working at the federal prosecutor's office since that eye-opening experience 8 months ago, and to be honest, I love it. I have formed friendships, gone through an incredible learning journey, and only feel majorly confused because of it. I got to this point because 1 year ago, I randomly signed up for a vacant year-long student employment position. First of all, I didn't think I would get the job, and secondly, I didn't fully anticipate the type of work I would be doing. I signed up out of an interest in law and saw it as an opportunity for professional development. As a peace builder and a believer in restorative justice, this experience has not been easy. I have felt guilty for enjoying it while feeling passionately about the ineffectiveness of the system. I have become more convinced in the need for restoration as I interpret the hurt caused by shaming. While I have continuously wondered if I am abandoning my values by working there, I realize that I am gaining valuable insight and education about the justice system from an insider's perspective. Additionally, I have formed relationships. The managing attorney has treated me with the same respect he showed me on that trial day and considers me a friend. The assistant attorney cracks jokes with me left and right and is genuinely interested in my beliefs. Their legal assistant makes me a better person every day through her kind words and contagious personality. We all share lunch and coffee on a regular basis, and friendships grow deeper in this informal setting. I have spent a lot of time thinking about my situation and role as a Mennonite and peace activist. At one point, I justified my job as working within the system to eventually change the system. Though I still see it like that to a point, I realized that that language will not take me far. Change can be threatening and seen as disrespectful. In order to make strides towards a more restorative system, I understand that I need to speak the same language as those who control the power. In this way, we are all on the same page and motives are transparent. I see myself as respecting the powers in order to positively affect the powers. I believe this is the key to peace-building efforts for all Mennonites, not just my own situation. While peace is possible in all settings and through all means, I believe it is necessary to engage those in power and build relationships in order to be most effective peacemakers. The first step to positively affecting the powers is relationship building. I guarantee that the conversations about restorative justice that I've had with my office mates would not be possible if we did not have a foundation of friendship. We put in the time and energy it takes to develop open, honest relationships. As peace builders, we must go the extra mile to ensure personal interaction. Whether we arrive to a meeting early or stay late to engage in personal conversations with the leaders, invite them into our home, or volunteer babysitting services, we begin developing a connection. Relationships expose the faces and souls attached to a name or title. And as the wise Mark Metzler-Sawin says, it is difficult to hate what we know. So I challenge you to get to know the powers you dislike. Maybe that means striking up a conversation with your child's principal, or writing letters to government officials, showing genuine care and asking personal questions, or inviting a business competitor into your house for dinner and games, but friendly games, of course. In showing humility and extending love to the powers in our own context, we will inevitably get to know them. Hopefully, it is a natural progression from this point towards respecting those powers. The second step on this journey is to maintain an effective worldview. Walter Wink favors an integral worldview, which emphasizes the spirit in every domain, including power structures, and recognizes our interconnectedness. Anabaptists, and young people in particular, appear to be moving towards a participatory worldview. Participation in all structural levels highlights this interconnectedness. In respectfully engaging the powers, I am proposing a new worldview that combines Wink's integral stance with participation to create an integral participatory worldview. As a whole, I think it is fair to say that Mennonites, while vigorously pursuing peace and social justice, typically work apart from the government or try to affect power structures from the outside. The time has come to move inside. It is critical for the broader Mennonite community to embrace this emerging integral participatory worldview and nurture it so that we are all involved in the peacemaking process. Now, I recognize a very legitimate red flag that comes with Mennonites' involvement in power structures. Wink writes, "We become what we hate." This awareness makes up the third part of affecting the powers. There is the chance that someone might get caught up in the quest for power or seeking acceptance at the expense of loosening personal values. Maintaining ties to our home, school, and church community can provide an element of communal support necessary while we engage the powers. From personal experience, conversations with friends and mentors have helped me process my journey. It has not been easy, but I feel like I am staying true to my Anabaptist values and will come to the end of the experience with greater knowledge of the system in a way that will fuel my peace-building work in the future. Returning to my initial story, the feeling in the pit of my stomach after that particular trial will never leave. I had a hard time adjusting to my job, and I'm still not adjusted. After meeting prisoners, building relationships with them, and witnessing firsthand the ineffectiveness of the system, I am more convinced than ever in the need for alternative solutions. By the same token, I have made lasting friendships at my job. I know there's a team of 3 dedicated fans who are rooting for me to succeed in whatever I do in life. I've even given my coworkers the little book of Restorative Justice by Howard Zaire. They took it seriously, and we've had follow-up conversations. Though this is a small step, it is my personal effort to affect the powers through respecting the powers. I am excited that at least one federal prosecutor's office now has restorative justice literature among its collection. I encourage each of you to work at respecting the powers in your own context. Again, I suggest 3 components that might help in pursuing this effort. First, recognize the importance of relationship building and work diligently to create lasting, genuine relationships. Secondly, maintain an integral participatory worldview. Appreciate the interconnectedness of all God's children and actively work to engage the powers. And thirdly, support yourself with a nurturing community and take time for personal reflection in an effort to maintain your own values while working amongst the powers. Respect nurtures relationships. It is crucial to gain trust, mutual understanding, and personal connection with those in power in order to positively affect the domination systems that are in place all around us. Effective peace builders are engaging peace builders. Thank you.
Our third speaker is Michael Harnish, and his speech is entitled, "The Rebellious Children, Reclaiming Our Heritage."
When my mother brought up the possibility of building a new house with an in-laws quarters, I assumed that my Harnish grandparents would be moving in with us. However, within 5 minutes of starting the conversation, my assumption did not hold up. So I finally asked the obvious question, which set of grandparents is moving in with us? Now, I should explain, because the answer to that question did not just have 2 options, Harnish or Straley. As a young child, my father died, and then my mom remarried a few years later. By God's grace, I then had 3 wonderful sets of grandparents who supported me. However, during this conversation, it never crossed my mind that my stepfather's parents, the Rohrs, would be moving in with us. I came into this Rohr heritage from the outside, but benefited from their hospitality as if I was part of it all along. Yet I never considered the possibility that I, at some point, would have to extend hospitality to them and take care of them as they aged. I took for granted the weekends at the cabin with four-wheelers. I enjoyed the feasts and presents around the holidays. They gave and gave to encourage me to join their family, and I never once considered how I could give back. Two central themes have dominated conversations concerning peace on the EMU campus this year. The first, peace with creation, runs deep into the environmental sustainability theme. The second, peace with other cultures, pervades interreligious dialogue as programs like Abraham's Tent at the seminary, Arabic classes, and cross-cultural exchanges lead us to more peaceful ways of communicating the differences and similarities between religions. My interest in religions stems from my own cross-cultural experience, where I enjoy the hospitality of Hindus, Sikhs, Jains, and Christians alike. During my senior year, many of my studies have helped reflect on the implications of that extreme hospitality despite such strong differences in religious values. On January 27th, I attended a lecture given by Gerald Shank entitled Theologies of Pluralism: Why We Need to Be in Abraham's Tent. His appeal to the audience was to recognize how hospitable Jews and Muslims have been to Mennonites while away from their home, and thus we should extend that back. My concern with the project dealt with the title and its implications. Half of the world is neither Muslim, Jewish, or Christian. And by naming the program Abraham's Tent, we automatically negate half of humanity. Thus, I questioned Dr. Shank on why the program excluded so many. His response was simple. If we can get it right with the Abrahamic traditions, the rest of the world will be considerably easy, or easier. I disagree with Gerald Shank that interfaith dialogue will be easy with Hindus, Buddhists, or even atheists. However, in theory, I agree that the conversation must start with the religions with which we can identify. Therefore, I will be even more narrowly focused by looking at the anti-Semitic structures within America and how we can offer hospitality as a religious majority. After reading some of John Howard Yoder's book, The Jewish-Christian Schism, I realized some sharp misconceptions held by most Christians. First and foremost, Jesus was a Jew. Certainly, this statement is fundamental to understanding Jesus historically. However, if this fact is not at the forefront of our theological understandings of reading the Bible, then Scripture is easily misinterpreted. Furthermore, Jesus did not hate the Jews, nor did Jews hate Jesus. Jesus came to fulfill the oral Torah and shift some of the rigidity of the law, not unlike many of his time. Yet Jesus' radical kind of Jewry is now perceived as anti-Semitic in light of Christendom. More importantly, Jews did not reject Jesus or Messianic Jews. In fact, synagogues were open to Christians throughout the first century. Yoder points out the accounts in the Old Testament of what could authentically be called persecution of believers in Jesus by Jews are very few. In the cases we do have, the agents of mistreatment are not qualified Jewish leaders. Thus, in Yoder's words, the sharp divide between Christians and Jews did not have to be. Something happened between the first century Jesus model of breaking the cycles of violence and divisions to today, which continues the violent, divisive model of Constantine and Hitler. Jews are our ancestors. Let's treat them as such. Secondly, the overarching narrative of Jesus' ministry can be read through a lens of Matthew 22:37, a call to love God and love thy neighbor. Jesus is issuing in a new time of inclusion an attitude of hospitality toward the enemies. Stories such as the Good Samaritan, food fellowship with the untouchables, and forgiveness granted to a prostitute illustrate the movement towards inclusion. But all of this is rather unimportant to a Jew because Jesus is no more significant than any other prophet. Thirdly, the Jewish community is scarred from the thousands of years of severe persecution and alienation. After living in exile under such extreme persecution for so long, the community's ability to live out their Jewishness has been completely stifled. Jews have lived under these exilic conditions in each land, from Exodus to Babylon to Islamic Spain to Auschwitz, Germany to America. America? A land of religious freedom, and the Jews are still experiencing exilic conditions? Yes. The rebellious Christian descendants of Judaism have not allowed their grandparents into a new land. But how? How are the Jews still feeling anti-Semitic emotions in the postmodern era? Name the last Jewish bar mitzvah you attended. Or the last time you celebrated Hanukkah. When was the last time that you celebrated Purim with your Jewish neighbors? Or honored dietary laws at Passover? Does the local grocery store provide Jewish or kosher meats? And still you might ask, aren't all the Jews in New York? Why should we care about their rituals in the name of hospitality? This is exactly the attitude that I want to resist when considering the impact of hospitality and peacemaking interfaith dialogue. Our posture directly correlates with our openness to certain communities. Thus, if we were to adopt and accommodate some of the ancient Jewish traditions, Christianity would be taking a great step towards peaceful relations with the Jewish community. We as Christians are inconsiderate of our ancestors as they live among us. Even though the majority of Jews live in New York and Israel, the impact of global hospitality extended even in Harrisonburg speaks loudly to all Jews. We could possibly hang a mezuzah on our doors and light Shabbos candles as a daily practice. Or perhaps we should move the Sabbath to fit with the Jewish Sabbath. Jesus never declared Sunday as the perfect day for church and rest. Showing respect to our elders is the best act of hospitality in the postmodern era. However, after conversing with a practicing Jew in the area, I realized two flaws with everything that I've said so far. The first is that I know what it's like to be in the Jewish minority. And the second is that I conducted the speech under John Howard Yoder's proclamation that the schism did not have to be. Ultimately, the schism did happen after Jesus lived on the earth, and I cannot pretend that thousands of years of faithful Christianity did not persecute the ancestral enemy. Therefore, my posture as a majority Christian, writing a speech on bringing shalom with the minority Jews, automatically involves an us versus them mentality. So, I propose, knowing that the schism has caused 2,000 years of tension, that we claim but not cling to our distinctive differences and be mindful of the privileges that come along with being a majority. Read the Old Testament without the assumption that Jesus changed it all. Recognize how celebrations of the Christian calendar cause grief to those who do not celebrate. Advocate for schools to be neutral, mindful of the fact that public schools are very diverse. Moreover, advocate for further separation of church and state, as Christian morals should not dominate legislature. These are ways to honor our differences while offering hospitality to the minority. As Paul says in Romans 14:21, it is good not to eat meat or drink wine or do anything that makes your brother or sister stumble. This statement can be extended to offer a stance of hospitality and peacemaking or shalom. Be ever mindful of your posture. Dialogue with both the intention to learn and offer differences, and honor your ancestors. I certainly did not want to give up all my teenage distinctions by allowing my grandparents to move in with us. However, I eventually wanted to return the favor of good hosting. I suggest that 21st century Christians serve as both guest and host, and to learn from and advocate for a minority population. I invite us to change our posture concerning our ancestors and honor our heritage as Christ followers. Thank you.
Our fourth speaker is Kate Nussbaum, and her title is Pursuing Peace from the Inside Out.
Think about everyday walking for a moment. What were you thinking about last time that you walked between places? In that moment, if someone were to have watched their stride, what would they have noticed? Perhaps it was fast and frantic, or slow and gentle, or curious and playful. Think of a time you went for a walk recently. How was that purposeful walk different than everyday walking? In our culture, too often walking is used as a means to an end. Our pendulum legs swiftly carry us from point A to point B. Our minds can endlessly drift from one activity or task to another without a larger awareness of our purpose or surroundings in mind. Perhaps we have lost the art of walking. Walking could simply remain pragmatic, but if we are mindful, it becomes an art. I believe walking restores the soul. Take a labyrinth, for example. It's not only a tool for meditative walking, but also a metaphor for life. The Christian life is often described as a journey with God that takes unexpected twists and turns along the way. A common way to use a labyrinth is to move towards the center as we let go of our worries and distractions. Upon arriving at that center, we wait, we listen, and we refocus on God. Jesus asks us to shift our attention from many things to one necessary thing, firmly rooted in God's kingdom. As a pilgrim, the hope is to leave the labyrinth renewed and restored, to go back out into the world to serve and continue following Christ. In that time and space, we receive the gift of rest and renewal for our souls. Practicing this presence of God is a way of pursuing peace from the inside out. The Hebrew word for peace is shalom. The concept of shalom refers to wholeness and restoration with God, with each other, with creation and self. This is the ultimate goal of reconciliation. Yet as Anabaptist servant leaders, too often we advocate for peace in the world while neglecting our own inner turmoil and need of restoration. We may serve in caregiving roles such as lay leadership, parenting, social work, nursing, or community development. In those positions, sometimes it's easier to keep giving to those in need and pain than to deal with our own inner brokenness. However, without attending to our inner labyrinth, we can quickly burn out. The question then becomes, what hinders us from caring well for ourselves? To put it another way, what alienates us from our sustaining life source, often leaving us feeling unfulfilled? Perhaps it's pride, or pressure to achieve, or fear of failure. For others of us, it might be cultural norms like busyness, or an efficient use of time. The Western culture values achievement, status, consumption, productivity and consumption, and encourages us to be human doings rather than human beings. Sometimes we simply suffer from too many options. As we know, a combination of these burnout factors can quickly lead to overcommitment, stress, anxiety, fatigue, and loss of perspective. Our weary walking becomes in bondage to the world instead of liberated by the rootedness in God. As a result, I found it personally a spiritual necessity to pursue peace from the inside out through solitude. Surrounded by so much inner and outer noise, the spiritual discipline of solitude is essential in becoming sensitive to the gentle voice of God. Restoring our true selves through solitude is not a selfish act. Rather, it's a treasured gift. Although internal transformation may not show immediate results, it's invaluable to our spiritual, emotional, mental, physical, and relational well-being. Jesus serves as an inspirational model to the rhythms of both an active and contemplative life. In the first chapter of the Gospel of Mark, Jesus has begun his ministry in the Sea of Galilee. After a long day of serving, Jesus rested. It says, very early in the morning, he got up, while it was still dark, left the house, and went off to a solitary place. Although his disciples were searching for him, Jesus recognized the need to spend time centering himself before going and serving again. Jesus lived both an active and contemplative life, eating and fasting, praying and healing, traveling and resting, and preaching and teaching. He models an example of cultivating an inner labyrinth as a means of restoration, peace building, and shalom. Remember a time when you received the gift of solitude. What was it like to enter into that transformative space? I have found when our outer distractions are removed, our inner distractions often manifest themselves in full force. We often use the outer noise to shield ourselves from our inner noise, our doubts, anxieties, fear, painful memories, or impulsive desires. Yet when we vulnerably journey inward with open and empty hands without anything to prove or defend, we are able to more clearly hear that voice that makes all things new. In the summer of 2008, I had the rare opportunity to spend 40 days and 40 nights in the rugged Wind River Mountains of Wyoming. Through a Christian Wilderness Expedition organization, a small group of us young adults journeyed into this place of transformation. During that summer of both physical and symbolic wilderness, God entered into the broken parts of my life, meeting me in my fears and speaking reassurance. For example, on day 30, I recall feeling physically exhausted from my 50-pound pack I was carrying, emotionally drained by some of the people in our group, and mentally frustrated by the swarms of mosquitoes around me. I was so distracted and discouraged by the mosquitoes, I couldn't even appreciate the mountain vistas. Yet God met me in that vulnerability and weakness as I surrendered to his voice speaking louder than my own. So I share a few stanzas of a poem I wrote from the end of that day when I set aside my own distractions to truly hear God. July 7th, 2008. Resting here on the mountaintop with the Lord, I wait, listen, and sing praises before his throne. Enthralled by his majesty, I catch a glimpse of his character. Small am I, with limited understanding. I see only a frame of the view of the vast mountains. Beloved and sweet daughter, declares my Abba. In the gentle and firm breeze, he whispers, you are mine. Take courage and do not be afraid. I am your rock, your shelter, and your protection. Trust me, precious one. My closest friend and bridegroom captures my heart once again. His faithful love restores like a gentle waterfall. We dance to the rhythms of the ebbing water, smile spread wide, hand in hand, allured into the wilderness to hear the shepherd's voice, I have fallen in love once again. I humbly confess, since my time in the wilderness, I've struggled to create time and space for solitude in my own life. Responsibilities and expectations often take priority over pursuing peace from within. However, since I have tasted and seen the rich blessing of solitude, I crave it more than ever. In the midst of distractions and busyness, it is still possible to practice the presence of God. Parker Palmer describes solitude in this way. Solitude is not simply physical isolation. To be in solitude means to be in possession of my heart, my identity, and my integrity. It means to refuse to let my life be dictated by other people or by an impersonal culture. Through spiritual disciplines, we can find the capacity to enjoy solitude. A broader understanding of solitude provides creative expression in that intentional time and space. For example, I have found walking, journaling, taking photographs, and listening to music to be particularly meaningful ways of restoring my soul. My challenge for each of us is to be more intentional in cultivating an inner labyrinth. With inner peace and restoration, we are more prepared to engage the world as servant leaders. The spiritual life moves us deeper into the world, not away from it, as we begin to experience the rich ways that God is transforming our own hearts. I encourage each of us to consider how we can integrate solitude into an active and contemplative life of peace building. May we be more mindful of using solitude to pursue peace from within as we discover the joy of being fully alive in this labyrinth of life. Thank you.
Our fifth presenter is Zach Hurst, And his title is Divide and Conquer, an Unlikely Slogan for a Peace Church.
Eight years ago, a small Mennonite congregation nestled in a rural farming community felt the first tremors of conflict. Their long-term pastor had recently resigned, and after struggling with no pastor, an interim pastor, and a new pastor who was promptly asked to resign, the church was shaken and hurt. As church attendance started to decline, a teenage girl, just entering high school, was noticing similar shifts in the youth group. In fact, shortly after the broader congregation challenged its leadership, the youth group did the same thing. By the time the young girl graduated, she saw the church her family had been a part of for generations suddenly look completely different in the aftermath of a divisive issue. All the young adults and most of the youth were missing. This evening, I urgently ask you to consider the harm the Mennonite Church has inflicted on its youth throughout a history of division, schism, and separation. It does seem a little ironic for me to stand up here and point out the hazards of splitting a faith community when many of us begin talking about the formation of the Mennonite Church with the offshoot of the Anabaptist movement from the Protestant Reformation. However, our history is very important to this discussion, despite its obvious contradiction initially. Within several years of its start, the leaders of the Anabaptist movement gathered in Switzerland to discuss and write a series of seven articles that would soon serve as a simple affirmation of faith for early Mennonites. The document was known as the Schleitheim Confession, and its message established peaceful living as a primary tenet of living faithfully to God. From Schleitheim, Switzerland in 1527 to the campus of Eastern Mennonite University in 2010, Mennonites have been persistent in serving God more faithfully through peaceful living. Also dating back to Schleitheim is an interest to maintain separation from people and places that are not connected with God's will. To quote Article 4 of the Confession, "Everything which has not been united with our God in Christ is nothing but an abomination, which we should shun." Article 2 outlines the use of the ban prior to breaking bread together so that, quote, "we may all in one spirit and in one love," end quote, "share the bread and cup." Currently, the Mennonite Confession of Faith still states suspension of membership as an acceptable form of discipline for those who have separated themselves from the body of Christ. So even in more recent history, these undercurrents of division and exclusion continue to flow between below the surface of congregational conflict. I believe these currents that started with Schleitheim are indirectly responsible for the trauma youth experience today, because they give permission for schism to resolve congregational conflict. Isn't it intriguing that the same document that established peace as a priority in the Mennonite Church also established a climate for conflict that ultimately hurts youth through this history, the less than peaceful process of separation? To better understand the schism history among Mennonites in the last 130 years, I read Fred Nisse's book, Disquiet in the Land. There he describes his study of 208 conflicts in Mennonite congregations significant enough to have secondary documentation between 1880 and 1985. From his analysis, there are two key points that I want to look at more closely. First, of 197 conflicts used in this research category, 36%, or about 71 conflicts, resulted in schism of some form. This statistic simply illustrates the frequency and commonality of schism as an outcome. Second, Nisse reports that the organization of the conflicting parties is more important than any other factor, including content, in determining whether a schism outcome is likely. Content was seldom a necessary cause and never a sufficient cause of schism, the book states. These findings parallel another study by David Brubaker in his book, Promise and Peril. As Brubaker studied 100 Episcopal and Presbyterian congregations to learn more about the relationship between change and conflict, he too came to the conclusion that conflicts are rooted in more human issues than content issues. The battle for the Bible may be a less significant causal factor for congregational conflict than more human battles, struggles for power, and disputes over ritual expression. He says, "When I spoke with David, he pointed out that congregational splits usually result from the intensity of the emotional process rather than the actual content of theology or leadership. It seems to me the findings from both studies confirm our human responses to conflict, either getting organized or protecting power, are the true factors leading to congregational schisms. Adolescents often find these human responses reveal contradictions between what's practiced and what's preached. This is especially true for youth of the Mennonite Church, who hear stories of international peace development and restorative justice programs around the globe, but find themselves in the middle of congregations at war. Even more frustrating is the fact that adolescents see the irony, but often are sidelined in the midst of conflict. David Brubaker gave an example of a church he worked with that never told or asked the youth about the conflict they were experiencing. Even so, the youth had picked up on what was going on and had possible solutions that the church had never heard. Youth are ready to manage conflict with the teachings of the church. Sadly, the example they often see is the church resorting to separation as a conflict resolution technique. That's little worse than compromise and far better than failure for each side. All this hypocrisy revealed by conflict threatens developing faith. Youth may carry scars with them for years after the conflicts they witness. Some of them are visible here on campus. In a congregational ministries class I'm a part of, we were asked to draw and describe our home church as if it were a single person. The personalities, physical attributes, and hobbies we gave them were all supposed to represent the character of the church. Out of 10 people in the class, 3 or 4 shared that congregational conflicts prompted them to use the images of a man on life support, a struggling single mother, and a man with a heart transplant. Each person had at one point been healthy and active until the pivotal point that changed them dramatically. We talked about these people as if they were real, because the pain and hurt, even the hope and optimism that strength could be restored, was real. These faint indicators of confidence show that young people have not given up yet. So seeing that our culture of conflict is influenced by our history of splitting and separation, and that youth appear to be negatively affected by that history, let's agree to adjust our conflict climate. Let's agree to do more research on how youth are affected by conflict. There aren't many studies done on this subject, and we have questions we can't answer without more information, such as, are youth leaving the church for this reason? Maybe simply asking youth what they experience will allow them a voice, an outlet to express discontent and frustration without losing interest in the church. Let's agree to not accept schism as a viable solution to conflict for anything less than fractures at the most fundamental level. If schisms are mostly caused by human conflict practices rather than ideological differences, then we should be able to address disagreements through better conflict practices and cut the schism rate to almost nothing. The topic of homosexuality is on the horizon and rising. It threatens to pull us in opposite directions. If it attempts to split us apart, are we prepared to say that sexual orientation is so fundamental to our faith that we absolutely could not stand to worship beside someone who thinks and behaves differently than us? Third and foremost, let's agree that the church should be a safe place for people of differing opinions to interact with one another, instead of isolating ourselves with people just like us. Media organizations, politicians, and many institutions, including churches, are being asked to choose sides in this polarized culture we live in. Let's use our churches to demonstrate an atmosphere where respect is automatic and not earned, conversation is passionate but not imposing, and disagreement is expected but not corrected. Just maybe, if these things can be accomplished, youth will see our positions of peace abroad correspond to our actions at home. Maybe they will see a genuine church that cares about unity even in the midst of difference. In the case of the teenage girl I mentioned previously, the conflict in her congregation did not drive her away from the church. In fact, she's pursuing a degree in peace and conflict studies here at EMU and hopes to one day help congregations like hers manage conflict more effectively. Though her journey looks positive, I believe youth could tell numerous stories that end quite differently. If we as a church change our attitudes about congregational schism, division, and separation, maybe we can develop faith more effectively in young people. Thank you.
Our sixth presenter is Grace Hersick, and her title is The Christians of the World.
What if we loved our neighbors? This phrase is almost cliche, yet what if we really did? What if the Christians and the churches of the world represented love? What if the church decided to live in peace with itself? The church seems like a sensible starting place for peace on earth, yet one church cannot independently bring peace. Perhaps we need to ask, what is church? Church is not one building, and certainly not one community of believers. It's a global entity reaching around the world. Church consists of many denominations and varying practices, yet is united by the commonality of Jesus Christ. This is every Christian's heritage. Yet this church is riddled with conflict based in millions of problems which prevent almost all sense of unity or collaboration. Can our message of peace be taken to the world without being shared internally? I won't suggest that we could possibly overcome our entrenched theological conflicts. As someone who's attended multiple denominations, I'm greatly aware of the oceans which separate us. Each denomination has multiple problems with other denominations. These differences range from petty to enormous. Our hostility varies from passive aggression to outright contempt. We don't interact, afraid that we're indirectly validating their errors by even conversing. Yet this story should not end with our independent resolutions towards passive hostility. Seeing ourselves as a global church requires returning to the roots of our faith. It's easy to focus on issues like predestination, the social teachings of Jesus Christ, sprinkling or immersion, infant or adult baptism, church order and leadership, the creation story, the peace or the violence in the Bible, the infallibility of Scripture, or even cultural differences. Important as these elements are, the cornerstone of our faith is love. Are we expressing love to our fellow believers? We should question why Christians isolate one another. Several things happen when we're exposed to people radically different from ourselves. We fear losing our individuality, our identity. We're forced to precisely articulate what we believe. We might discover ourselves in the minority, an unpleasant position where we risk our internal sense of security. We have to overcome stereotypes and judgmental attitudes. We have to make conversation with people we may not inherently relate to. We're essentially opening ourselves up to a whole new culture, and because the subsequent culture shock involves our core identity of faith, it's an experience that we prefer to avoid. As humans, we like to create defined categories, lenses which give meaning to our world. We decide that Sunday morning is a sanctioned time for worship, or assume Christians who wear headscarves must be conservative. Yet often these categories become a hindrance, and we judge individuals based on one element of their identity, or judge churches based on historical difficulties and current ignorance. We neglect to move past our categories and instead build stereotypes. It's easy to forget that we share commonality across our differences. We believe in one God. We read the same scriptures. We all acknowledge the supremacy of Christ. We all recognize the significance of grace. We all seek to be a positive force in the world, and we all desire to do the right thing with our lives. These are positions which Christians from any church might agree on. These convictions lead us to live somewhat similar lifestyles. We all shun behavior such as deception while promoting other behaviors such as honesty or integrity. Yet inevitably, we can't all agree. We differ on interpretation of said scriptures, and we have different opinions about how to make the world a better place. Differences overshadow commonalities. Attempting to build connections with people of different theological persuasions is much the same as building relationships cross-culturally. We have the advantage of speaking the similar language of Christianity, but the words have very different and involve very personal differences. Because of this, because of historical problems, and because of fear, churches isolate and condemn one another. In short, isolation is easier, engagement is difficult, and so we continue to question the authenticity or the sincerity of a fellow Christian's faith. Yet will the story end here? Is this the best that we can expect from a faith that changed history? We must start by acknowledging the humanity of the other. It is not us versus them. They are human. They might light more candles on Sunday or vote differently, but they are people of faith. I only recently learned this lesson in my life. Growing up, I was exposed to very few Catholics, and a pastor once told me that Catholicism was a cult, and I considered believing him. A few years ago, though, I actually met several Catholics, and I realized that, like me, they are sincere people of faith. I regretted my unkind words. By never meeting anyone from that church, it was easy to judge. I learned that it doesn't take much to change our outlook. Perhaps you've heard suggestions that churches could possibly overlook theological differences and unite on social issues. Realistically, we don't start by collaborating. We must first transform our relationship from negative to positive. The only reason for engagement might be simply because it's the right thing to do. The end goal of interaction isn't social collaboration, but expressing love to our neighbors. It's the peaceful, Christian thing to do. It's our responsibility to extend complete and motive-free kindness. I struggle with these issues as I question my own position in the global church. I don't know which church I belong to. I am constantly the other. I meet people of faith in many communities, yet I cannot join one community without being judged by the others. Both sides focus on their differences, issuing harsh words of condemnation. Yet ironically, both seek positive social change. Why do we allow denominations to become labels? I question why politics and tradition blind us from seeing other people of faith. What if we purposely sought out Christians with unusual stories? What if our faith was that strong? Practically, extending love and peace involves changing how we think of other churches. It involves seeing ourselves as one body, not us versus them. It involves not ignoring those with whom we disagree. It involves only choosing to speak words of kindness. It involves going out of our way to meet fellow Christians and break down our mutual ignorance. It involves breaking bread and taking communion together. Finally, it can involve collaboration. By acknowledging that we base our convictions on different passages of Scripture, it improves our ability to relate. We can turn our judgments into curious questions in relationships characterized by love and peace. Pastor Greg Boyd notes that when you have Christ in common, all these differences are rendered insignificant. We can still talk about them, but harmony should not be based on hegemony or really anything else. My message is not fraught with complications. Beyond peace is the fundamental upon which our faith and theology lie. We know to love our neighbors, to love our enemies, to love the Lord with all our hearts, that out of faith, hope, and love, the greatest is unquestionably love. We know if we speak in the tongues of men and angels, give all we own to the poor, and have faith that can move mountains, but don't have love, we are absolutely nothing. Love is the foundation for our faith and all subsequent work. From love comes justice. From love comes a desire for change. Love is the prerequisite for peace, and peace's greatest ally. The global church must be the model for this love and peace. Can you love your Christian neighbor? Is our faith that strong? Christianity has transcended personality, gender, age, race, culture, geography, ethnic heritage, even thousands of years. Yet can Christianity transcend itself? Can we rise above our prejudices and insecurities? We cannot expect to build peace by alienating portions of the church. We bring shame on ourselves, suggesting that both our faith and the power of peace are not strong enough to bridge these differences. It is not our responsibility to question the authenticity of another Christian's faith, but to live ours. So how strong is our faith? Are we too set apart from each other? If Christ's love and peace can reach around our world and change history, it can reach into any church. What if our faith was strong enough that we intentionally sought out Christians from other churches simply to share love? Civility leads to kindness. Kindness leads to relationships. And relationships lead to change. This is where we decide that differences are problematic, but we choose to make love and peace stronger, to turn contradictions into paradoxes. So in conclusion, as the Anabaptist saying goes, let the Christians of the world agree that they will not kill each other. May the Christians of the world also agree that they will act in love towards one another, with our actions, but more importantly, with our words. Thank you.